Hello, thanks for tuning in. You're about to hear a fascinating conversation between iconic Australian director Bruce Beresford and prominent SMSA member Peter Rainey. This conversation is from a free event, which also included a screening of Bruce's award-winning film, Driving Miss Daisy. This recording was made in the Henry Carmichael Theatre at the Sydney Mechanics School of Art, situated on Gadigal land. I hope you enjoy this conversation.
I'll say a little bit about the format of the day. Those of you who were here when we screened Schindler's List and know that Tom was sitting up here where Bruce is, and I must say, the two of you know how to pull a crowd.
Good.
It'll be a very simple format. We'll have Bruce and I will be in conversation, if you like, for approximately half an hour, something like that. Then we'll see the the film. Now, as I said in my handout, Bruce is an unbelievably busy man, and we are very lucky that he's here. He sent this letter to The Australian in 1992. I've turned down a large number of invitations to screenings of Tender Mercies, a couple of Don's Party, and even declined to go to Paris, all expenses paid, where a few of my old Australian films were being screened. But I'll gladly bore anyone to death anywhere about a new film. So we're very lucky. We're very lucky.
Well, this isn't a new film.
This isn't a new film. But you're not, and that's why you're not going to bore anybody.
Oh, no, I can still do that.
And then we'll do that, and then we'll screen the film, and then Bruce will come back at the end of the film. He's going to do as Tom did, and take himself off to a bookshop, or go up to the Tom Keneally room and do a bit of writing or whatever. But he'll be back to have a Q&A with the audience at the end of the film, which I know you'll enjoy. Now, some questions. I've got a few prepared, but then again, I had a few prepared for Tom too, and I think I'll wound up asking one. Okay, so a few questions. A lot of this, of course, is based on what I've read about Bruce or what I've heard about him in interviews and so on, or what a few people have mentioned to me. But one thing's clear, I think, is that he's always wanted to make films. Clive James in a lovely poem says this originated in the womb. That's when he wanted to start writing screenplays and make films. So my question is why? What was the genesis? What was the fascination, or if you like, the desire to make films?
Well, it's just, can you all hear me?
Yes.
Oh, you'll be sorry, okay. It's just that when I was very small and we lived in Springwood in the Blue Mountains, there was a movie theatre there then. And I remember I used to, I was always fascinated by it. And although I was only like 5 and 6, in those days, my mother used to let me walk to the school and back unaccompanied. It was about 3/4 of a mile. No one ever do it now. Anyway, coming back, I used to realise it was interval at the movie theatre. It was just after 3. So I used to get hold of some adult and follow them in. And I could see the second movie. And I became fascinated, and I thought, gosh, this is really what I want to do when I grow up. I was so taken with the images changing on the screen and the drama of the people, you know, the drama of the story. And I thought, that's what I want to do. And that must have started then when
But to create it, not to act it. But
no,
to
I didn't want to act in it. I wanted to be the person who put it all together.
Okay.
And I realised that, I think I realised very, very early that the key person on any film is a director.
Okay.
I mean, the director, he's like the painter who does the portrait. The director really should have an individual stamp, and I can look at almost any movie on television, say, and without seeing the title, it could come on, and I can tell you in a couple of shots who directed it. It's like you can look at a Picasso or a Renoir or something, and you'd say, "Oh, that's a Renoir," even if you know nobody's told you.
Okay.
I can pick directors because they all have an individual style. Even they may have no talent, but they'll still have an individual. They'll still have an individual style,
Irrespective of the genre, say.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Lovely. These days, maybe a bit more difficult now with the streaming services, where a lot of the films are done through groups, and they're done with what they call showrunners, and they sort of churn them out, and they're just all made in exactly the same way. And I can say, oh, that's a showrunner's film. There's nothing there. Okay. But feature films, they have a sort of, definitely. And, a lot of people get in touch with me, want me to look at their films, and I sometimes, I looked at a young guy's film the other day. He sent me a film called Friends and Strangers, done in Australia on a very low budget. And I could tell in the first 10 minutes, this guy's really talented. Okay. So I'm doing what I can to help him get another movie going.
Good on you. And is that film coming out? Or is it out?
I don't know yet.
Okay.
We're still trying. I mean, he's in France at the moment, but I could see straight. I mean, he had that individual stamp, that was straight away. He didn't. I looked at this film he made and I thought, it's a film. It's got a narrative and it's got characters. But I realised when I was watching it that I'd never seen a film like that.
Okay. Lovely. Well, we'll keep it. Mm-hmm. Friends and Strangers. Bruce just mentioned to me before that he's directed 34 films, and I've got in the handout that it's 38. And he said, but the IMDb, sometimes they've listed films that he's directed that he's never heard of.
Yes, that's the internet. You've probably found this, Tom. Have you? You've ever looked up yourself on that?
Oh yeah, I've got blokes still thanking me earnestly for writing The Power of One.
Well, I see films that I've never heard of, and they have a little bit of the plot. And then I went on to IMDb. And I said, look, I registered, and I said, look, I am Bruce Beresford, and I'm letting you know that such and such and such and such and such and such are not films I directed. They never made any changes. They never took any notice. So they're all still there.
Well, the ones you've made, you, from what I know, you have a great reputation for directing newcomers, or unsung actors, if you like. Getting a Wisdom, Laura, Debbie in Puberty Blues, for those who've seen that. Trilby in The French Dwellers, and Susan, who was initially called Kate someone, for Paradise Road. How do you manage old hands and novices, so to speak?
Well, there's no real difference. I mean, there's actors are generally very good to work with. I mean, with all the films I've done, I don't think I could name four actors who are a total pain in the bum. They're very cooperative and they work very hard and they really go for it. Do you agree, Tom? They do, don't they? They're usually very good. And if I'm auditioning like kids, I have done a few films with basically children. I get them in and we have a meeting like this and they read and I talk to them. And you can usually tell, you think, this child is good. You get them to read it. Sometimes they just have an instinct and you hear it and you think, that's what I want this character to sound like.
Okay.
And then if they're children, I always make sure I meet the parents, because I've found out through experience that if the parents are nice, well-balanced people, the kid will be great. If you meet the kid, like I did when I did Double Jeopardy, remember that?
Yeah.
A little boy in that, I thought he was quite good. Then I met his mother, and I thought, the mother's a rat bag. I thought, this is going to be tricky. And I still used, against my better judgment, I still used the boy. Mother was a nightmare, and it made it difficult. Then he would have little tantrums and things.
So when you talk about casting the film, you're also, for kids, you're also casting the
always
parents.
Meet the parents. When I did Mao's Last Dancer, we knew a little boy for that in China, and I met a lot of children, and I said, I picked out the little boy that I in fact used, and then I said, I've got to meet his mother and father. And they said, oh, you like him, and you won't be able to talk to them, they don't speak English. And I said, no, I still want to meet them. Anyway, the mother and father came along, charming people, and we went, it went like a dream with that kid.
You mentioned that there's four, you could think of four off the top of your head, actors who were pains in the bum.
I won't tell you.
But however, you have written about one who had an enormous, an eccentricity beyond belief. When he was, the direction was he had to open the door and come in. Do you remember that? I'll read it to you.
Oh, yes, you have to remind me.
I'll read it to you.
I wrote about it, did I?
Because it reads quite well. Here we go. Talking about, you mentioned that there were two people that you'd been angry with on a set, and this was one of them, and this is what he did. He had to open a door in a film. The instruction is to open a door, right?
Yep, I know, I remember it, yeah.
After an insane request that he could not simply, this is the person Bruce got angry with, after an insane request that he could not simply open the door of a film set to enter the room, but he had to go out to the car park, get out of the car, then wend his way through various sound stages until he finally reached the room where we were shooting, and then opened the door. I mean, how on earth do you deal with somebody like that?
Yes, he was a very, what was his name?
Walsh.
Oh, J.T. Walsh. He was a very sad man. He was a very talented actor. When we actually filmed with him, he was marvellous, but he was crazy. He was a drinker, and not long after that, I think he committed suicide. And someone rang me from the New York Times and said, oh, J.T. Walsh is dead, and, you know, he was in your film. What do you say about him being dead? I said, well, it was probably the best thing. And they said, can we publish that? And I said, well, yes. But they didn't.
I think that's in the book. Albert Finney's got rather a nice quote about your dealing with actors. This is in a lovely book about Bruce by Peter Coleman. Albert Finney said, Bruce Beresford has a wonderful Australian directness. He's like Mashinsky, who directed me in The Green Man. If Bruce thinks it's bad, he'll say so. An English director will say, that was marvellous, darling. Now, so my question is, you've also said that the camera photographs thoughts.
Oh, yes.
And emotional truth has got to be effortless and simple, otherwise it sort of doesn't work. Do you want to care to mention two or three actors that you think have got that quality?
Well, I've worked with a lot of great actors who have that quality. Certainly Albert Finney did, because they have that knack of when I'm watching the scene being done and they're talking and the camera's there, for me, it all becomes completely real. And I believe, and sometimes the assistants are always saying to me, you forgot to say cut again. And the reason I didn't say cut was because I was enjoying it and it seemed real. And I didn't want to stop them, even though they'd run out of dialogue. But one of the actors, Robert Duvall, who I directed in Tender Mercies, he won the Academy Award, and he was one of those actors who was just as interesting when he was listening to someone else talking as when he had the dialogue, because you could see he was never out of character. And every nuance and every thought that was going through his head, even if his expression didn't change, it was all there on the screen. And the camera picks it all up. And so, you know, I remember once saying to an actor, I was called cut, and the actor turned to me and he said, why did you cut? He said, I didn't make any errors. That was the dialogue, I did it. I said, yes, you did, but you were thinking of something else. And he looked at me for a second and he said, you're right. He said, I was thinking about something and it was there at the back of my thought. Sorry, he said, let's do it again.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you see that?
You can tell, you know.
Did you see that on the screen?
No, I watched them through binoculars as I'm directing.
Through binoculars?
Yeah.
Okay, what? Well, ordinary binoculars.
Yes.
Okay. To see the expressions.
And I always watch the scene through binoculars So I'm getting every nuance, which is, I mean, remember, people watch these on great big screens. Mm. Even these days, they watch them on great big TV screens. Mm-hmm. So if I'm watching through binoculars, I'm picking up every nuance. I mean, it may sound rather eccentric thing to do. Yeah. And the so crew, sometimes I said, oh, where's Bruce with the binoculars? it's because I want to, if those performances aren't right, it won't work.
Yeah.
It can look great, it can be cut well, it can have terrific music, but if the actors don't pull it off, it won't work.
A bit like somebody in the theatre at the opera, looking at the faces on the
stage. Well, I think it's the same with stage plays. I'm often aware in plays that somebody's not concentrating. They're doing the cues, but, you know, it's a bit off. I mean, it's... For movies, they've got to be thinking the character as they're playing it. Mm. And people like Duvall, Finney, a lot of actors, I did one, Tommy Lee Jones, okay. He was the same. He was always completely in character. And he said to me once, he said, Bruce, you're so lucky I'm in this film. That was David Devlin. And I said, why am I so lucky, Tommy Lee? He said, who else could deliver this dreadful dialogue and make it sound convincing?
Was he right?
He had a point.
So there's a few actors who can do that. Do you want to mention a couple that can't?
Well, I wouldn't have worked with them.
Okay.
No, I mean... There's lots of very fine Australian actors. I've been watching the last few nights Boy Swallows Universe. Have you seen that?
Oh, yeah.
It's very, very well done. Yeah. And the actors never seem to me to make a false move. And each one of them really seems to be the person he's playing.
Okay.
It's, an example to good writing and good directing. Yeah.
What was Gough like as an actor?
Who?
Gough.
Oh, he didn't have much to do. And he was playing a prime minister, and he was well cast in that one.
That's back to your casting. Yes. I've got a casting.
We also had, in one film, I had, before Gough, who was the prime minister?
John Gordon.
Gordon.
John Gordon.
Yes, I had Gordon in. He was, he wasn't so friendly. So can't we... What are you waiting for? I said, well, I've just got to get this tracking shot of you along here. He said, well, what are you doing? I said, well, we'll do it. He was pretty impatient. He wanted to get away.
Yeah.
No, Gough was amiable.
Amiable, right. This little quote comes from Bruce's book, The Best Film I Never Made. And you say this was in 2009. Film is a great art form, and I find it's even a lot of fun. Along with a fair amount of frustration dealing with all the problems. It's even a lot of fun. What's the film that's given you the most fun?
I think they all are. They're all very enjoyable otherwise. Otherwise I'd have to go and get a real job. I love the technique. I love putting them all together. I love creating it with the actors and then the editor and then the final version and then it's often great to sit with an audience, doesn't always happen, but to sit with an audience that really likes it. I mean, with Driving Miss Daisy, the one you're about to see, that was made, Warner Brothers rather reluctantly agreed to distribute it, but nobody wanted to finance it, and it was made, it was financed by an independent Canadian company on a very low budget. And then when we made it, when we finished it, Warner Brothers said, well, you've done it, but it's not, they have distribution rights, but they said it's not worth releasing. We won't put it out. And Richard Zanuck, who was the producer, said, well, what we should do is have a test screening. And they said, it's not worth it. And he insisted, and we did. The audience loved it. And then Warner Brothers very quickly changed their mind.
They saw money.
They made a lot of money. Yeah. Without investing anything. Except they did a very good job with posters and promotion. They had to do all that.
That was the result of the film they were thinking of screening at Christmas Falling Over or something.
Yes, the thing that really helped was they had a big Christmas release called In Country. And that was their big movie for the, that whatever, 1990, I think. And In Country dived. Nobody liked it. And they were desperate to get another film. And then they called me and Richard in Richard Zanuck's office, and they said, "Where's that film about the old Jewish lady and the black man?" And I said, "Well, we've still got it here." And they said, "You better bring it over to the studio." And then that became their Christmas release.
Okay. And it certainly took off. And as everybody knows, it won 4 Academy Awards. Most people are probably aware, possibly even seen, that John Lennon's come to life again. I can't see you, though, making a movie which with dead actors via artificial intelligence.
Oh, the artificial, no.
I can't see you doing that. But you have watched a lot of films. Is there any actor that you've never worked with that you would have loved to have worked with?
Wendy Hiller. Okay. Does anyone know Wendy Hiller? Yeah, she was in the original Pygmalion with Leslie Howard. And she was in one of my favourite films, I Know Where I'm Going. And she won the Academy Award in Separate Tables. And I always used to look at her and think, there is a great, great actress. Sorry, I should. This is a bit obscure now, I think. But I saw.
Well, no, a lot of people here. This audience knows a fair bit
and
about
I saw
obscure
her on
films.
Stage. When they did Lady, this film. God, now I've got confused. Driving Miss Daisy in London, Wendy Hiller played Miss Daisy. So I was so excited about meeting her. And she did it without getting the accent right, the southern accent. But I said to the playwright, Alfred Ury, who wrote it, was there, and I said, "What did you think of Wendy?" And he said, "That's the best performance of the role I've ever seen."
Okay. Now I want to turn to opera. We've got about 5 minutes or so. And Bruce's writing, and some of you will have seen what he said about Mary Humphreys, and a couple of weeks after that, there was a rather lovely eulogy in the paper for the Australian director, Michael Blakemore. Bruce wrote that. And his writing is very, very funny. And it's worth reading to get the flavour of the man, I think. But this is something about opera. Unfortunately, there are often so few singers who can vocally handle the demanding roles that casting frequently becomes ridiculous. Even Zeffirelli's magnificent Turandot at the Met had a soprano who looked like a Bulgarian weightlifter. In fact, she was Bulgarian and will have a second career if her voice gives out. Now, you've directed 10 operas. You've directed 10
more
operas.
More, I think, but go on, yeah.
Right, more. Well, what's the appeal? Why are you directing operas?
Oh, I became obsessed with opera just like I did with films. But later, when I was about 14 or 15, I had a friend at school, King's School, who wanted me to go with him to a production of it wasn't Don Giovanni. Oh, anyway, it was at the old Elizabethan Theatre in Newtown, which has been demolished. And I didn't want to go. I said, opera. I wouldn't like opera. No, I don't want to go. And he said, "My cousin's coming." And he had a very pretty cousin. I said, "Oh, she's going. Well, maybe I'll come along." And I did. And I was completely captivated by actually the cousin and the opera. And I thought it was, I've really been missing something with this. I mean, I thought the passion involved of the drama and the beautiful music settings with the vocal line, I just became completely captivated. Mm. And this continued. I mean,
you've directed quite a few.
Directed quite a few. And,
have you got an opera that you'd love to direct?
Well, the one I'm trying to set up now is Peter Grimes, which hasn't, the opera by Benjamin Britten, which I think overall is my favourite opera, because it's It's got an amazing libretto. It's an incredibly powerful story. And the music is so moving. I mean, I feel like a bit of a creep saying it, but every time the music starts in the courtroom scene, I find myself weeping. It's just so moving.
Hmm.
So I'm trying to set that up with Melbourne Opera, who I've done two operas for recently. They want to do it, but it's a big opera, expensive.
So what would that be, 2 months' work?
No, it wouldn't be too much work. It's getting the finance together to do it.
Okay.
Yes, it's quite... I mean, I said I don't want to do a small-scale opera. I don't want to do a sort of, you know, two-bob version. Mm. I said you need the fishing village that's set in, you need the pub, you need the storm scene, you know, that's raining, and the Where's Peter Grimes, the door burst open with a great flash of lightning, and the whole audience, the whole chorus yells out, Peter Grimes! Oh, it's breathtaking. Mm. But you can't do it on the cheap.
Okay. Well, I think everybody here listening to that will hope that the finance suddenly materialises and you can pull it off. And also,
it's a wonderful opera.
Who knows, maybe your fortunes of Richard Marnie, you might be able to do
that too. Oh, the fortunes of Richard Marnie, yes. It's I wrote that as a television series. We can never interest anybody in that.
Mm.
I don't know why not. Mm. It's a great story.
Just touching on that, talking to Bruce before, the number of projects that he attempts to get up that sort of fall over. There's two lifetimes work.
But this happens, I think, to most directors. Certainly the ones that I know, you're always trying to get this going or that going. And unless you've got three or four sort of dangling there, you'll find yourself broke.
Yeah.
You know, I've got actually four projects at the moment that I'm hoping go. I've just done an adaptation of a novel by John Coetzee, Boyhood, the wonderful South African writer who lives in Adelaide.
Mm.
And he liked the script. We've been through the script, he liked it, and we're now... there's a company which is based in London and Pretoria. I've got a Zoom call with them on Monday. That's what I do now, spend all my life on Zoom calls.
Yeah. Well, let's hope certainly that one comes up, because I know quite a few people here who know the book.
Well, the book is a masterpiece.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, well, look, it's 2:00, and that's the time we were going to allow for this. Bruce likes, as you go to tell, Bruce loves telling stories, and he knows
how. Boring?
No. He knows how to tell them. So let's watch one that got the Best Picture Award in 1990, a film that, when it was introduced, Billy Crystal at the time quipped, a film apparently directed by itself. I.e. Bruce didn't do anything. Well, I think this film will show you too. Bruce has said that, or at least I've read, that he feels he's meticulous about composition and lighting, and this film will show you that in spades. It's beautifully composed and lit. So Bruce, thank you. We're going to let you disappear for about an hour, 40 minutes, or whatever you wish you would like to come back. But Bruce will be back for a Q&A with you, with the audience, after we screen the film. Now, it's going to take us 4 or 5 minutes or so to just make sure this is all set up.
I can check the first couple of minutes of the film.
Oh, lovely. Okay, lovely. Okay. And give us a tick or...
No, I just...
You want to see what it's like?
Well, I want to see that it's in focus.
Excellent.
And loud enough.
Well, we want it to be in focus, and please, if it's not loud enough, let us go. Okay, but thank you. Let's thank Bruce for willing to be here.